A baseball game, a day in a park with friends and family, fishing in a remote stream, work, travels, providing for loved ones, or heading out for adventures. Whatever you do, whatever you enjoy, you need your health. The original Guide to Men's Health is presented by the Washington State Urology Society to help take you through the steps necessary to get the most out of life. If you have invested in a retirement plan for your future, why not invest in your body? After all, it makes better sense to retire healthy and enjoy your future. These podcasts are a guide for how to take care of yourself. If you take care of your car and maintain it, why not do the same for your personal machine, your body? If you know you should but haven't yet, the information in these podcasts contains some easy recommendations for where, when, and how to get started. Follow the podcast as we explore men's health with renowned experts and embark on a journey towards better health. On this episode of the original Guide to Men's Health, we will be exploring supplements, nutraceuticals, herbs, and natural products. We're fortunate to have Dr. Bryce Thompson, ND, MS. Dr. Thompson received his naturopathic doctorate and Master's of Science from the National University of Natural Medicine in Portland, Oregon. He is now a postdoctorate research fellow in an interdisciplinary research program between integrative practitioners and researchers, the University of Washington, and the National University of Natural Medicine. Dr. Thompson, welcome.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
I think folks are very interested in natural products. Obviously, billions are produced in income from companies that produce supplements. Mm-hmm. There are some rules about supplements versus FDA approved. And if you want to go into a little background, when people hear an ad on TV for a supplement or a natural product versus an FDA approved, what's the difference there?
Yes, that's a huge difference, and it's a really important one to understand. The supplement industry doesn't have any pre-market regulation tied with it. For instance, when we get a new drug out, it has to go through the FDA process, it has to be vetted, it has to be tested for safety and efficacy. Is it going to actually do what they claim it's going to do? And the opposite's true for any sort of supplement that's marketed as a supplement. It's actually considered a dietary food source to supplement the diet. I'm using air quotes because that's the direct quote from the Act, which was passed in 1994. So with dietary supplements, since they don't have to have any pre-market regulation, anything can come out into the market, whether or not it is scientifically valid or not, as long as it is was in the food chain before that act was passed in 1994. If it's not, then they have to go through the FDA process and prove that it's actually safe. Not that it's effective, just that it's safe if they plan on introducing it into the food chain in 1994, after 1994. And then once a product is out on a market, it's there. The only thing that the dietary supplement can't do is claim any sort of health benefit or disease process. The structure and function claim is the only allowable claim that a dietary supplement can say that it improves, that it's going to improve structure and function, that this supplement is going to improve your heart health. It's not necessarily going to improve somebody with congestive heart failure. They can't claim a specific disease process or anything, because that would be against what a dietary supplement is, that it's a drug at that point.
So if it just said it will make you have more energy?
Yes, then that would be fine. Right. The one thing to note is that if whatever they claim on the label, they are then held liable for. Then this is where the FDA and the Federal Trade Commission kind of overlap. So oftentimes supplement makers get in trouble for claiming something on the label that isn't a pharmaceutical claim, but it actually still doesn't do what it's claiming that they do. And that's actually a Federal Trade Commission violation. That's false advertising, in a sense.
So again, going back to a hypothetical, it will give you more energy. How would anybody investigate if there are no clinical trials that are required for outcomes, how would somebody be able to say you're making false claims? How does that come about?
And that's really the hard part. Most people I find with dietary supplements, they hear about it from word of mouth. They say, oh, my friend started taking ginseng and they started improving his energy all of a sudden, is a common one, for instance. And if people really want to critically assess and really want to assess whether or not a dietary supplement would be good for them, outside of, because, you know, everybody's the specific advice of go and see your medical practitioner and ask them if this is right for you. Outside of that, you should look on government-funded websites would be my first stop. So the Office of Dietary Supplements within the NIH has a good list of what the mechanism of action are, what studies have been done on all of these drugs, and also if there's a recent adulterated product that's been found on the market, they will flag it in their database. They have several databases available that are open to the public, and it's funded by taxpayer dollars, so everyone has access.
So I, from our conversation, assume that a supplement is a natural product. You're saying it's unadulterated. So they're one in this, a supplement and an herb would be one and the same?
Yeah. So
herbal medication?
Yeah, they kind of all fall in that same category. I use the terms interchangeably. When I say a natural product, most people tend to kind of lean on that it's an herb of some sort or some sort of plant ingredient. You get real crazy. You can do like desiccated animal parts at some points. There's some for like the thyroid, but that's a medication. But sometimes there's a supplement company out there that I do know that does desiccated like adrenal glands, and it does exist. Natural products kind of covers that entire realm in my book. If I'm talking about like a dietary supplement, that's even an even broader term that covers most of your non-herbs, so your multivitamins and minerals. And
so let's say we have a company. Mm-hmm. And we take a natural product that we're going to produce for more energy.
Okay.
We have to produce that in a consumable way. Does the consumer have to be concerned about some of the processing and contaminants that they might be taking in? Is company A equal to company B equal to company C? Who's producing this? And how do they find out if there's some contaminant that could be harmful to them, if it's imported from somewhere? How do they know what they're taking, what they're putting in their body?
Yeah, you've hit on another big topic and since there's no pre-market regulation that happens, there's not a lot of enforcement on manufacturing practices going on. The FDA does require all manufacturers to be testing their product, whether or not that is actually happening. It's kind of up in the air. There's so many manufacturers out there, they can't test everybody all the time, make sure that their product is completely unadulterated. Most of these companies are getting large shipments from overseas or someplace else, and maybe that one batch was contaminated for some reason and it wasn't necessarily the company's fault, but they're supposed to catch it. So how does the consumer know? The best way that you can protect yourself as a consumer is you look for specific markers on the bottle. If a manufacturer is with their salt, in my opinion, they have agreed to get two marks, or one of the two marks that I associate with good quality, that they've tested that the product is what it actually says it is. It's a USP, the United States Pharmacopeia mark. They have to abide by certain manufacturing standards, and they also have to prove that the product is what it is. And then there's also an NSF mark, kind of like the USDA organic label. You have to follow certain things and to call something organic. The same with these two marks, the USP and the NSF mark that would be on the label. You have to follow certain manufacturing standards and processes to confirm that they are what they say they are in order to have those marks on your label.
So USP, NSF.
Yes.
And they are clearly found. And so if you're in a large marketplace, mm-hmm. and there are so shelf of supplements,
yes.
you look at the label and you choose the one that has those, you'll be better off.
Yes, good. Of course.
As you bring then the supplement, and somebody has general supplement, I mean for mm-hmm. vitamins, I guess.
Yeah.
But then there are more specific supplements, right? Mm-hmm. For conditions, which is why you went to school.
Yes.
So a little background into that. I mean, what do we know that works? And if you want to list some conditions specifically that you mm-hmm. have recall, go ahead.
Yeah. Herbs are, I think are fascinating. They have a whole host of constituents in them, and they have a long history of use, which is kind of why we use them, is because they have been effective. Whether or not they're as effective as an antibiotic or as another pharmaceutical, we throw those all up in the air because a lot of those effectiveness studies have not been done back to back. A lot have, and they've proven that the pharmaceutical is 9 times out of 10 more effective for treating a certain condition. A lot of consumers that I saw when I was going through school and doing my clinical rounds were concerned about side effects and whether or not it was appropriate to take it. And so the biggest one that I can give an example for was I would get the patient that would come in and say, my doctor just told me that I have type 2 diabetes and that I need to start taking metformin. I don't want to start taking metformin. And they were, you know, really balking against this whole, they have to take a pharmaceutical to bring their diabetes under control. And they want to know what natural product they can take to bring it back under control. To me, that's a conversation starter of, well, why don't you want to take the pharmaceutical? Because if you're using a supplement as in the same sense that you would use a pharmaceutical, in my mind, then we're not doing the same thing. You're treating the supplement as a pharmaceutical, and the pharmaceutical has more evidence behind it. Let's talk about that. If they truly do not want to take the pharmaceutical for whatever value system, or for, you know, they want to try bringing their diet under control beforehand and stuff like that, then, you know, I will work with them to help them bring their diet and everything under control. But then if we're looking at a natural product, we could say something like berberine in place of the metformin. And berberine has a lot of evidence, and in terms of the same mechanism of action as metformin, being an AMPK inducer, it'll lower your blood sugar a little bit. We won't see as great an effect as we would with metformin. Typically, if a patient is, you know, they're at that pre-diabetes or like just over the cusp of the diabetes stage, then I'm like, okay, then if we want to bring diet, lifestyle, everything under control, and then we can try the berberine for a while and see if it all works out for you, then great, awesome. And then we don't have to go to the metformin route. But then it's constant monitoring by both the patient and me to make sure that that those numbers don't continue to increase, because then their health is at risk. And so we would then say, start talking about more rigorous types of treatment, such as metformin or moving forward. Yeah.
And you bring up something that I think that listeners may not really realize. When they go to a naturopath, the naturopath is going to say, oh, don't take that pharmaceutical. Don't take that medication. You're trained in recognizing disease processes and advising patients who may want to supplement something and say, well, what else can I do to be healthier? But at least in my experience, when I see a referral from a naturopath, it's not because naturopaths said, don't go down that route. They're helping the patient with some other therapies, but they're fully behind what has been prescribed. So yeah, cancer treatment in the case of a lot of the patients that I see.
Yeah.
It's like, we'll keep you healthy during your cancer. You know, we'll try to give you something that will give you some more energy, give you some help rebuild your gut bacteria. We will help you with side effects of whatever chemotherapy you're undergoing. But the message isn't, don't do the chemo.
Yeah, of course.
So let's go back to then exploring that relationship of somebody who comes in who says, I don't have a primary care doctor, sees a naturopath as their primary.
Yeah.
You're going to be looking at them stem to stern.
Correct. Yeah. So if a patient were to come in to me and they said that they wanted to establish primary care with me, this is obviously varies by state where naturopathic doctors can practice in which realm they can practice in. So here in Washington, we can actually be their primary care physician. And as you know, that comes with a whole host of things that we have to do to make sure to ensure that this person is staying healthy. You know, we're constantly monitoring their blood pressure throughout their life, and we're constantly monitoring their various risk factors that they could develop over their lifetime to prevent, because a prevention is worth an ounce of cure. And that's really our training, is always like the prevent. And then when something does happen, we're going to jump in an integrative setting. We're always trained to be very, very integrative, and that we're going to bring in as many people as we need to make sure that ensure that this person is healthy. And we have our toolbox, which can sometimes involve pharmaceuticals, but a lot of emphasis on the nutrition and the diet and let's do some microbiome stuff, try to make your gut a little bit healthier too, because we know that can influence your health and greatly. But I'm going to leave the primary aimed treatment for your cancer to your oncologist, and we're just going to work side by side. And I'm going to follow the evidence in how this should follow. And our visits are also, you know, our visits, whether or not we can go into a whole theoretical debate and philosophical debate, whether or not this is actually feasible for naturopathic physicians to do. But typically our visits are longer. They're at least an hour. We talk about top to bottom, you know, how's not just the disease process, because the person isn't just the disease process, but also how are things at home? How are your stress levels? How's work? Do you have any other random symptoms that have popped up? And we're checking in on everything that we can possibly touch in, because we really like to view the person as like the whole being. As most doctors, I would argue, of any sort would want to do. Most MDs, that's why they went to school, I would imagine, is to help people, and they would hope to spend more time with their patients 9 times out of 10. But because of the system and way that it's geared, oftentimes they don't get that long of a patient relationship. And so we kind of fill in the gaps there as much as we can, and then try to work in an integrative setting as much as we can.
So are there supplements that you recommend routinely just for general health for people?
Oh, that is a tough question. You know, there's that argument of, you know, if you take a multivitamin every day, all you're doing is making your urine very expensive, right? Because you're urinating out most of those things. The counter to that argument is that, you know, majority of Americans are following the standard American diet, which we know is deficient in a lot of our vitamins and minerals. And, you know, there's all this data coming out that's showing that the soils are being depleted and the plants no longer contain the nutrients that they used to. And then some people, even in an organic setting where there's supposed to be more micronutrient densely grown. And so it's an interesting battle that I find myself in. It was like, should you take something on a daily basis and spend that money? It's very person by person, in my opinion. It's very, very person by person. I do stand by that if you are a relatively healthy adult, that you should be able to get all of your nutritional needs met through your diet.
So the act that Congress allowed supplements to be advertised also funded the Dietary Guidelines for Americans, which is a great diet book. We have it in a prior episode on diet, one of the authors who's at the Hutch, and people don't realize it's free.
Yeah.
And is done every 5 years and has great information on diet. So I always like to remind listeners about that because, you know, we're talking about natural products and diet is so important, as you said, in getting basic building blocks.
Yeah.
So when patients come in, what are some of the common things that they would be looking at? Let's say sleep health. Are there good supplements for sleep health?
Yeah. So the one that I think is the most common, I would think, for sleep health would be melatonin, right? And there's a current debate about what dose of melatonin is appropriate. There was this myth in our community for a while where we shied away from melatonin for a little bit because there was a worry that taking melatonin would suppress your endogenous production of melatonin because your body produces it naturally. That's turned out to not be the case. People have taken high doses of melatonin for a very long period of time and not had any change in their own endogenous production. What I find with melatonin is that it's a really trial by error. You know, there's this range in which you start prescribing in, and some people respond at a really low dose, like 0.5 milligrams to 1 milligram, and some people take around 3 milligrams, and that seems to be okay with them. The side effect is just like any sort of treatment that you're going to have for sleep is going to be, it might make you drowsy the next day. Right? We can't, like, any treatment has risk, even if it is a natural product, always remember that. And so melatonin may make you drowsy the next day if you have to bump it up to a certain dosage in order for it to be effective for you. I think it's all trial by error by the individual. And you should probably work with a practitioner in, you know, assessing whether or not it is working for you. But the baseline, the basics, and we always have to go back to the basics because the supplement's not going to answer all of your problems. Go back to the basics of, like, is your sleeping environment conducive? Let's make it as happy and healthy as it possibly can be. Is your room dark? Is there less disturbances throughout the night? Is it relatively colder to the rest of the house? Do you have your cell phone in bed with you? We all know that we're not supposed to be scrolling through the New York Times right before we go to sleep for so many reasons, blue light being one of them. The other is read the news and your heart rate will go up. I guarantee it. But are you doing the basic things first And yes, we can add a supplement or even a pharmaceutical on top of those things if we really have to. Let's build the bottom. Let's build the base first, and then let's add things as we need.
So let's talk about seasonal allergies.
Yeah.
Go get a beekeeper honey, mm-hmm. pollen. What happens if somebody comes in and says, I have horrible seasonal allergies?
Yeah. The beekeeper pollen treatment used for seasonal allergies, I have never used that one personally on a patient before. The theory behind it is that what you're doing is you're taking all of the antigens that your body's going to be reacting against to give you the allergies, right? And you're putting in a concentrated syrup and then you're taking it orally. When you're doing that, when you take something orally, we're trying to shift that immune response into much more of a tolerance level. For someone with seasonal allergies, they tend to be more in that IgE histamine type of reaction. And if we can actually get the body to switch to an IgA-mediated reaction, which is what's happening when you're taking something orally, your body's like, hey, food's good for me. I don't really necessarily want to have an allergic reaction to it. If we can get it to switch over to an IgA, that's non-reactive. That's just protective. But it's non-reactive and you won't get the allergies. So that's kind of the theory, is that we're trying to class switch some of those, that immune response, over to a much more of a tolerance level. Same theory that with allergy shots. That's why with an allergy shot, like if you have a really anaphylactic shock against peanuts, someone will go in and they'll get allergy shots for an extended period of time. And they're giving you very small microdoses of peanut antigen to kind of say, trick your body into saying, oh, this is something that's just kind of around and it's not something I need to waste energy having a reaction against. Kind of the same theory. I would not suggest that you do this with anything else, but seasonal allergies, it tends to be the road that some people will go down.
What do you use?
For seasonal allergies, I tend to be more, I use a product called quercetin. It's an enzyme that's found in the pineapple family. And it tends to be, the mechanism is, they go back and forth on this guy. That first there was some like, oh yeah, it breaks down histamine. But now it's coming out like, hey, actually it might be blocking the histamine receptor a little bit. So that's kind of the one that I tend to go for. The kicker with that guy is that it doesn't work too much once you've started your seasonal allergy season, it doesn't really help you too much. It's kind of has to build up in your system over time. And by the time it's gotten to an appropriate level and the cells have all turned over and everything, then you're already out of your allergy season anyways. And so I tend to use it in prep. If I know that for someone's going to have like a really bad allergy season, I would
start early
and then, you know, like a month or two ahead of time. And then when they're in it, they take just the same dose and then they stop once their season is over.
And that's called again?
Quercetin.
Found in most.
It's in pineapple. Yeah. It can be found in some of your like natural food section stuff. You can also find it online relatively easy.
So you want to spell it for people?
Yeah. So quercetin is spelled Quercetin.
And if they went to a natural product store, would they find it packaged?
They should find it packaged. Another one that people will use in the same sense is nettle. In the old traditional herbal medicine, that was the one, they'd steep nettle leaves and then they'd drink a nettle tea for a while.
So nettles is...
Nettles are, back in the old school traditional herbal uses, nettles steeped in as to the tea has been used as a fortifying agent and also as a anti-allergy agent. I find that to be effective. If you're a heavy tea drinker, most things, if you have to drink it in tea form, you have to drink a lot of tea. You have to take it several times throughout the day. So if you're a heavy tea drinker, like your hot drinks, then hey, maybe that will work for you. But I find that most people don't want to drag around a bag of nettles with them all day and be steeping tea, you know, four times a day.
In the patient who comes in with, you know, I have reflux and just digestive that a naturopath might look at.
We would definitely tell them the same thing that an MD would when it came to their digestion of like, GERD is, or reflux is due to a large part diet, given that we've ruled out everything else that could be more serious, like a H. pylori infection or an ulcer. But if you just have the basic reflux after you eat a lot of tomatoes and pizza, you know, that the acronym that we would use in school is cut out the crap. which is cut out coffee, cut out your refined grains, and your processed foods. Those tend to be your big offenders when it comes to the GERD picture. If somebody is, you know, they're doing all the things with the diet, or they can't do anything, because there's a lot of people, they have minimal control over their diet due to whatever constraint, then they could add a supplement in there to potentially help with things. And so, you know, we'll do things like digestive bitters before eating to kind of get the digestive process kind of up and roaring before we put food in there. Find that actually tends to help. I'm a little confused as to how that tends to help. My personal theory is that it just preps the body and it's like, hey, we're going to have some food here soon. And it's instead of a real abrupt response when somebody eats food, they're ready for it. Bitters is one that a naturopathic doctor might use. Another one that has a really good amount of effectiveness for me that I've found is the licorice. They'll use a glycerated form of licorice, which means they've removed the compound out of it that can be kind of toxic at high doses. And you want to look for that, called DGL, or deglycerated licorice. And they put it in a capsule and then you take it and it kind of coats your stomach and adds a little bit of a coating to it and kind of calms the stomach down. Another one that we would use is marshmallow root or ulmus. Same effect. That one is more fun to give to patients because we tend to do it in a powder form and say, you know, mix it in your drink, and then it, if you sit there and watch it, it'll turn into like almost gelatinous type of stuff for the patient, and then they have to throw it down, and the concept is that it's coating on its way down. I find that to also be really effective at protecting the gut lining.
And of course, everybody's interested in improving mental function and memory. Mm-hmm. Anything that's legitimate at this point?
No. I mean, biggest bang for your buck is diet and exercise, man. And that it just, if they've always said, if we could put exercise in a pill, we'd cure so many things that all of us are affected with. And so, you know, exercise, you know, not only does it increase your cardiovascular outcomes, but you could get that surge in BDNF, which is like basically miracle growth for your brain, that's produced in your gut, and it actually does cross the blood-brain barrier. If you eat a diet heavy in fiber, you take something, or like with vegetables and stuff, then you're going to produce a lot more butyrate from your colon, and butyrate is also very good for your brain cells to have, and that does also cross the blood-brain barrier. So, you know, the diet and exercise thing, it can't be minimized at all. In terms of taking a supplement to help, outside of people that are, you know, oh, my mood's a little bit off or type thing, they're describing more of a mood problem. But if they're like just wanting to improve their memory and be their top selves, no, there's not much evidence out there for increasing memory and stuff. There's a little bit, if you look at the meta-analyses for omega-3s, there's that effect size is just across the line as far as it having an effect, but it's very small. And if you have a diet that is, you know, relatively good in omega-3s, so you eat fish more than once a week, and you have a lot of flax in your diet, a lot of chia seeds, things that are really high in omega-3s, then you're probably gonna not see much of a benefit with those.
And jumping back to bowel regularity, I tell patients about all brand buds.
Mm-hmm.
Used to be 51%. I think now they changed the label. It's 47% of your daily fiber.
Yeah.
And flaxseed meal, either the meal or just get the seeds and flax seeds themselves and grind them.
Yeah.
Depending if you want to buy a grinder and just grind them. Pretty good for regulation.
Of course. They're great for regulation. And for all of those, like, it's this, you know, drink plenty of water when you do them because they can work in the opposite direction if you're not. And, you know, fiber is fantastic. Can't minimize fiber's importance for bowel movements at all. it's fantastic. Another one, off the top of my head, I would just, you know, focus on that regularity piece. If you're having problems with having more than, if you're having too many bowel movements in a day, if you feel like you're having too many bowel movements, then let's try looking at some of the foods that may be irritating your bowel that may be causing a little bit of an issue. If we're looking at the constipation end of things, then first let's look at hydration. Let's make sure we're drinking plenty of fluids throughout the day. And then let's also start looking at things like fiber. Let's start looking at maybe a little bit of magnesium in there, because it also assuming that there's no other reason not to use magnesium, you know, it can have a little bit of a bowel movement effect, and different forms of magnesium can have more or less of an effect. But yeah, just fiber, 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 and fiber.
So then patient comes in and says, I'm pretty arthritic and hard moving around. What's your go-to supplement for helping people with joints and movement?
Yeah. By the time that patient has found their way into coming and seeing me, they probably tried glucosamine, which would be the one that most people would reach for. The glucosamine data behind it is a little mixed. There's some studies that have shown effectiveness, but it'd be real tiny. And then there's some, and the bigger study that has shown effectiveness, and it's really tiny. And so it tends to lean the effect size a little bit farther on that positive end. But there's a lot of studies that have shown that it's not effective for the joint complaint area. And I honestly think it depends on the individual's, you know, own disease process. What's happening? Are we looking at a rheumatoid arthritis, which is obviously much more advanced? Or are we talking about just plain osteoarthritis that happens when we start getting a little bit older? Or is it because this person's joint has had severe damage throughout its life and it's just breaking down faster than the rest? And so I think when a patient comes in to me, they've usually already reached for the glucosamine, and they've found that it's not effective and they're looking for something else. And so if we were going to add another one in there, then I would go for most of your anti-inflammatories would probably be the ones that I would go for, just for minimizing that inflammatory reaction as much as possible. And the one off the top of my head, I think, is Boswellia. Boswellia has an anti-inflammatory, kind of your same on that Cox pathway as well, a little bit more benign than a typical NSAID would be due to its poor bioavailability. But it tends to act more like a leave, is what I tell people, because it tends to work better for musculoskeletal complaints as opposed to like your Tylenol does for it. So yeah, that's kind of my go-to for that one. But God, arthritis, you get the hard one. That one's just, it's just hard. Like, you've done damage and now we're just trying to minimize it as much as possible. Again, hydration. If that joint doesn't have enough fluids in it, then it's obviously going to cause more pain. And so I would always emphasize like hydrating and make sure that you're hydrated throughout the day. It's an avascular tissue. It's going to take like just making sure that your urine is, you know, on the brighter end of once a day is not necessarily enough, because it's an avascular tissue. It needs a constant positive hydration status in order to really, in my opinion, in order to really like soak up as much hydration as possible and be as fluid.
In cardiovascular health, I know that citrulline ends up going down the nitric oxide pathway.
Yep.
And that is available as a supplement. Do you have thoughts about what people might take who have some underlying, you know, they're being treated for their coronary disease or their peripheral vascular disease, or they want to maintain better erections later in life and they have some elevated cholesterol and lipid issues?
Yeah.
And say, what else can I do to get better blood flow through there?
Yeah. So for your like ED kind of route, there's a couple that we can go down. And the funny thing is that there's pharmaceuticals for all of these because the mechanisms are not new. But if somebody wants something that's a little bit poor in the bioavailability status, they want to try something that's probably going to have a little bit more of a withdrawn effect, and maybe it won't have like a side effect that they're associating with it. You can go the horny goatweed is the common name, and I find that funny that that's an aphrodisiac type agent, but it has a compound in it called irisin. It will bind to your alpha 1 and 2 receptors, adrenal receptors in your brain, and will kind of inhibit those receptors inhibit erections, and so then you're more likely to be able to have an erection if you're taking something like that. Then there's Yohimbe. That's an African bark that someone might take. And that one, its active constituents are also on the nitric oxide kind of level. It's supposed to have more of that dilating effect on your smooth muscular tissue. And so you're going to be able to hold and maintain an erection. As far as other things, like from a naturopathic perspective, we would be like, do you have diabetes? Do you have peripheral vascular disease for specifically an ED issue? Because we all know that those small little veins are very delicate. And if you have...
yeah, the arteries are smaller than coronaries.
Yes, the arteries, sorry.
No, you're correct, though. Most of it, though, is veno-occlusive issues.
Yeah.
Because the little spaces that fill with blood are lined just like the inside of an artery. And if they mm-hmm. don't stretch out, they don't occlude the outflow. So it all has to do with both in and out. And sort of the ability to keep your cardiovascular system healthy leads to better quality erections. So.
Yeah, for sure. Some people, for heart health, a lot of people will take CoQ10. That one is just, as far as improving cardiovascular outcomes, not really. Someone will supplement it when they're taking a statin because statins tend to inhibit your endogenous production of CoQ10, which is an important antioxidant and also a part of the electron transport chain, right? And so that's why you can sometimes with the statin therapies get those myalgias. And that's the theorized mechanism, is that you're just not making enough CoQ10. And that's why you end up with that, with those myalgias sometimes. And so then CoQ10, you can supplement orally. It's pretty bioavailable. I haven't seen any data of using it to treat somebody who has myalgias with the statin therapy. I've seen people worried about it, and then they take the CoQ10 to prevent potential any interaction with the statin therapy. But it's a very good antioxidant as well. So it's going to protect your mitochondria, and it lives in those lipid membranes of your cells. And so it's one of those few that lives in those membrane areas. And so that's a really good place for an antioxidant to be, prevent damage. Yeah.
And then with my specialty in men's health, we look at BPH.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're moving on to the urinary system. Somebody comes to you with trouble voiding and you think they have some prostate enlargement symptoms, benign prostatic enlargement. And so I don't really want to take any of those actual medications, but I picked up this supplement I heard this supplement on TV.
Yeah.
What do you tell them?
Maybe. it might help. The funny thing is that most of your supplements out there to treat BPH are herbs that are doing the same thing that a medication would, the 5-alpha reductase inhibitors, right? And so any of your herbs that are going to be doing that are going to be doing the same thing as a medication. If you just started having BPH and you're like really medication wary, I would say, maybe give it a shot. Let's see if it works. Problem is that those guys are not really bioavailable, so the concentration of the active constituents in those herbs don't really get too high. But then maybe it'll work. I have seen it work for some people. If you have a really established BPH and you want to come off of a 5-alpha reductase inhibitor, I've never seen that be successful. I've never seen somebody able to reduce their dose or come off of it with any of the herbs. But then again, my clinical experience, I'm relatively new in the field, so my clinical experience is minimal. I'm sure there are some doctors out there that have been able to.
You know, patients come in with the prostate supplement. They all have saw palmetto. And in our studies that we've looked at, saw palmetto did not outperform a placebo. Mm. But I always tell patients, look, as long as you're not taking it to prevent prostate cancer, because there's no data that says it does that, and you're not taking it to really prevent prostate growth, because we can't absolutely say that, but just symptom-wise, if you feel mm-hmm. better, great, and you want to spend the money, I don't see any problem with it. The one of the herbs that does seem to have some actual potency in placebo was Pygium africanum.
Mm-hmm.
It's usually in the supplement industry distribution, not in high enough dosages to really be effective. They actually would have to just go get Pygium by itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one thing to really make sure when taking any supplement is supplement bottle will come with a suggested dosage, but it would behoove you to look up online to see what an actual dosage would be like, because oftentimes it's not high enough. And there's two reasons behind that. One is that the supplement industry is trying to cover their backs. And so the lower the dose, the, you know, less likelihood that there's potentially going to be a problem. or a symptom that occurs due to taking their supplement. And then two, the bottle lasts, they can put less in there, right? And then you can, then they don't spend as much money making the supplement as they would. But there are some good supplement companies out there that have correct dosages.
And then if we move to, what do you see as problematic supplements? You know, what could be harmful?
As far as broad categories of supplements go, anything that talks, and men's health is a perfect example, honestly, because this is a huge, huge problem in the men's health world of like anything that's going to increase your libido and make you the most amazing, constantly turned on person on the face of the planet. No, it's probably fake. If it's a new supplement that's been out there for a while, I always try to vet that one out for really, really cautious towards going into a new brand or a new that just hasn't been on the market before, because a lot of these supplement and lots of these supplement companies, they'll get shut down and then they open up under a new name just to move the product off of their shelf so that they can make their money back, whether or not it's actually what it is. So anything new, watch out for. Anything that's going to help you gain muscle and gain mass, yeah, no, probably not. And also just look at everything with a critical eye. I'm a big fan of asking myself when you go into a supplement store and being like, man, if I'm hoping that this is going to be the miracle cure for me, don't I think that if the miracle cure did exist, that it would be out and available for people as the miracle cure? A lot of these herbs and supplements that are on the market, they've been on the market for a really, really long time. And if they actually did cure or make things amazing for an individual or for a group of people suffering from something, it would be well known and well established. And a lot of the cases, it's not what these claims that with these supplements and advertisements that they're doing. Weight loss is another one. You know, if there was a magic cure for weight loss out there, the fad diets are, you know, we go from left to right on whether or not which one is going to be the best. You have your macro counting, and then you've got your ketogenic, and then you've got back over here to your Atkins diet. And, you know, some of them have some of efficacy behind them, but just be really, really cautious in how you approach these things, and also be very, very critically aware.
So in someone who comes to you and a man who says, I think I have low testosterone, and they come to us, there's very standard protocols for mm-hmm. evaluation, because it's multifactorial, right? Somebody, mm-hmm. you can have 10 guys come in with the same symptoms, and there may be 10 different reasons for it, and it isn't all low testosterone.
Yeah.
But if somebody is really just interested in supplements, what is DHEA?
Mm-hmm.
How does that work? Does it work?
DHEA in terms of testosterone supplementation is, I would say it's mixed in my experience with it. So DHEA, it's that precursor to building those hormones, your testosterone being the one of interest that most guys end up taking DHEA for. The problem with the DHEA supplementation is that hormone metabolism is so balanced, right? And if you take a bunch of DHEA, you're going to raise a bunch of these other hormones as well, because DHEA is also a precursor for them. And your body likes to have things balanced. And so it's going to shift the metabolism of these hormones around to keep that balance. And yes, your testosterone levels may go up, but so will some of your other hormones that you're maybe not as interested in raising. I find that if it works for people for DHEA, it works. And it works very clearly. It's not this like ambiguous zone that we find ourselves in. But if we're talking with somebody who, you know, they have clinical symptoms and they have low test and they've been tested and everything else is, you know, been ruled out as to why they have clinical symptoms, because they can all pop, anything can be to low testosterone nowadays, it seems like. And so when you go through the same testing procedure to make sure that it's not due to any XYZ disease, and you reach the final conclusion of, yes, it is low testosterone and we can supplement your testosterone levels. If you are at that point of supplementation, DHEA is not going to cut it.
And then if we looked at population who look at these ads,
mm-hmm.
may have trouble evaluating,
mm-hmm.
maybe doesn't have the expertise to go to the online resources, which we'll talk about in a moment, mm-hmm. but that's certainly why there's naturopaths.
Mm-hmm.
And the expertise of naturopathic programs is in helping people and guide them through if they really want to go through the natural product pathway, or in addition to what they're taking, there's good guidance there.
Yeah.
How does somebody find a naturopath besides the Yellow Pages?
Yeah, that's a good question. And there's a little bit of confusion. There's what we call lay naturopaths, and then there's the naturopathic doctors. And you want to make sure that the naturopathic doctor that you're going to go and see is one that went to one of the 4-year doctorate programs, not an online or even like a 2-year certificate program, which those do exist. And those individuals do practice in states where my degree is not licensable. And they also practice in states where it is licensable, but they can't use specific verbiage and names and stuff. So if you're trying to find an actual certified naturopathic doctor that went to a 4-year medical program to assess the literature and look at things at effectiveness and work in an integrative setting, you can reach out to the State Association for Naturopathic Doctors. They're usually very active in keeping tabs of most of the naturopathic physicians that are in their state. So if you just type in State Association Naturopathic Doctors into Google, then you'll find usually whatever state you're in, a state association. And then also there's the American Association of Naturopathic Physicians. They have a Find an ND tab. If you just click the button, then everyone that's enrolled in the AAMP will be available to you to look up. And oftentimes their specialties and what their expertise are.
And then if we want to revisit online resources, somebody's mm-hmm. more interested in finding out if the supplements they're currently taking mm-hmm. are useful, where do you send people to?
For online resources, most people are familiar with MDIT, WebMD, for better or worse. but that's a good one for getting a very broad picture of what your supplement could or could not be and what is the actual effectiveness when it's held to like certain standard for like the pharmaceutical industry is held to, which I believe supplements should be held to. But if you're looking for more like of your mechanism and what are the individual studies and stuff, I would always point somebody towards the Office of Dietary Supplements website. For medical practitioners, there's the Natural Medicines database that exists. That one is really good. It has a drug herb interaction checker. It's very conservative in its assessing the literature and assessing whether or not a drug and an herb will potentially interact with one another, which I really appreciate. That would probably be my first go-tos for the consumer. Go to the Office of Dietary Supplements if they want to look up what their individual supplement's all about. There'll be just so many resources that they could read forever.
And then I'm going to wrap up by asking you, what advice would you give to patients who are going to have surgery as far as supplements they need to make certain their doctor is aware of and perhaps stop prior to surgery mm-hmm. that could increase propensity for bleeding?
Yeah.
Because a lot of people are aware of aspirin, certainly if they're on blood thinners,
yeah.
but they forgot to put down supplements.
Yeah. The big one is their omega-3s, right? They take a really high dose of an omega-3 every day, or not even a high dose, a medium, small dose, and it can increase your bleeding. My biggest advice is always be transparent with your physician. The last thing that you want is for a surprise to happen, especially when you're in surgery. And your physician wants to know these things. I would give them my full list of supplements, every single one of them that's on there. Your surgeon will know which ones and which ones won't interact. And if they don't, then they will find out because that they are very, very invested in making this surgery very successful. So all of them would be my answer. Make sure that they're all there. But omega-3s is a big one, and anything that could potentially affect your bleeding time. But that's going to be on an individual basis. And first, pre-surgery, I might just say, let's cut them all out. Because a lot of it we don't know. There's so much we don't know in dietary supplements. So
yeah, so that's very reasonable advice. They're not necessarily harmless because there could be side effects that we don't know. Just mm-hmm. for that period, usually a week before, stop, let them get out of your system. And then you can resume after you've healed. And
mm-hmm. And that's been our advice whenever we've had a patient going in for surgery is we're going to pull everything back because there's not evidence. It's not positive or negative, but we don't know. Yeah. It hasn't been tested, so we don't want to find out with you.
Well, this has been truly enlightening. I mean, we've gone through organ systems, and we can't go through every supplement, but I think there's enough there for people to have a sense of when they're listening to the TV or radio and they hear something advertised, maybe how to find more information, who to go to, how to assess this. And then, we did talk about some common issues. So, Dr. Thompson, thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
This completes another podcast chapter of the Washington State Urology Society's original Guide to Men's Health. This is Dr. Richard Pellman reminding you to take care of yourself. The Washington State Urology Society wishes to thank all contributors who volunteered their time and knowledge. The information presented is the opinion of the speakers. The Society also wishes to thank Sean Fox for his invaluable technical assistance. Music theme, San Juan Bells, written and performed by Dr. Dave Weidig. The podcasts are the property of the Washington State Urology Society. Reproduction and use without the express consent of the Society is strictly prohibited. For more information about men's health, visit wsus.org or visit your physician or care provider.